Thank you very much, Richard, for this flattering introduction. I mean, if you got that sort of introduction, you ask yourself, is that actually me he's talking about? But yeah, you see, there's maybe some similarity still between the picture and what you see here in nature. But yes, thank you very much. Richard, of course, is my mentor on the Bournemouth University board, and we have a very close and friendly relationship, as he pointed out. But thank you very much for this flattering introduction. In general, ladies, gentlemen, and colleagues and friends, and in particular Karen and Carl coming all the way from Brighton to this lecture, welcome to this inaugural, which, as you see, is entitled The Effects of Brexit on the European Union, the UK and Dorset. So some people were pointing out that this is a far-reaching subject, but you might have noticed I've left out the world economy. I don't think there will be an effect, to be honest, but so keep it a bit, keep the ball a bit low in that sense, I would suggest. And I take a particular perspective, namely the one of the migrant. And you might have guessed who that migrant is. That's me. I'm the migrant here, and I come to that in a moment. It's just some colleagues pointed out their astonishment about my attire, which I have rarely the occasion to wear, and I still enjoy wearing it now. And actually, to be honest, I tried to avoid this tie because Donald Trump was walking around in this tie. But mine is different. It has some white dots on it, so I'm still wearing it again. So this is just a typical introduction. I'm very grateful for Barclays having us here. I did come on another day to inspect the facilities, sort of thing, and I can promise you there is the world's second biggest natural harbor outside there somewhere after Sydney. So sometimes it can actually be seen. I also think it's great having this at Barclays, not just to reach out to the public, maybe in particular to the financial world, as I'm trying to manage this particular department here. Come back to that later. But also it brings me back to my personal roots, because I started my professional career as a bank apprentice. So I did a bank apprenticeship because simply I originated from a family of bankers, so grandfather, father. So university, what do you want to do there? Do something real. And I actually did it. But after this apprenticeship, I wanted to know more, actually. That was curiosity driving me to university, and I went to the Free University of Berlin to study. So now I'm a little bit under adrenaline, I must say, but I don't want to do this gesture here. I hope I don't cut myself. That would be a bit embarrassing. But I think it's a good idea to cut out a star. So this is the Brexit, the EU flag from Brexit. Although I must say, this is just a gesture, a symbolic gesture, because this flag has only 12 stars. So we don't need to cut out the UK in that way. There won't be new flags to be printed or so. And the spirit of this flag would be expressed in the following terms, namely: against the blue sky of the Western world, the stars represent the peoples of Europe in a circle, a symbol of unity. And their number shall be invariable, set at 12, as a symbol of completeness and perfection. This was the view of the Council of Europe in France in 1955, and it hasn't changed. So in reality, we won't cut our flags, but I thought this is a nice start as a symbolic action here. So now, as part of the introduction, I would start like to start with the subtitle of the lecture, namely A Migrant's Account. I did I did say that I am actually the mind, and as you might have guessed from my terrible accent and then also the umlaut in the name, I'm sort of made in Germany, yeah? So made in Germany, hopefully as reliable as a Volkswagen I would have hoped. So that's the introduction. And being German has some implication, which I send out as a proviso actually before I start lecturing here. Namely, first of all, there will be no humor in this talk. So the Germans obviously have no humor. So you will be bored over the next half hour, 45 minutes. There's actually something to look forward to, because thank you, Mark. This was a brilliant idea, actually. We will have Beck's beer, Rhine Riesling, and Pinot Noir from Westphalia. So we have some German products which might lighten up the evening afterwards. You probably want this to be over very soon without any humor rushing to the wonderful supplies we have in the back. So first of all, no humor. Secondly, as I am the topic of the lecture, I am the migrant. I can talk about my favorite subject, namely myself. So that is making life relatively easy. Also, I like to say I am an economist and will try to concentrate on the economic effects of Brexit rather than what some people in this room might think to be more important, namely the politics of Brexit. And that's very difficult to disentangle. I will make an attempt. Hopefully I will succeed, but economics and politics of Brexit are sort of so closely intertwined that I will struggle. I can tell you now already I will struggle, but I will try. I will try to look at the economic effects here. And just give you a little bit of background of me before I lecture. My first migration happened actually in the early 90s when I migrated from Hanover to what was then West Berlin. I can't help mentioning the footnote here that this country used to be ruled by Hanoverians for centuries. Yes, there are some migrants here at a more senior level, and they have been around for quite a while. I mean, the House of Windsor was invented against the back of the First World War, but it is the bloodlines are still House Saxe-Coburg. So it's Hanover still. So I went to West Berlin, which was at the time not part of Germany. In the 90s, it was territory of the Allied forces of France, the United Kingdom, and the United States. So I migrated actually into the American sector first, and then to Kreuzberg, which was the British sector. And I must say, the Berlin times were fantastic. Berlin didn't just attract people like myself who came there for studies, but it also attracted people like David Bowie or Sid Vicious, who are interested in punk, remember, and Nick Cave, of course. So it was an interesting place to be, rather unique, actually. And I would say that then with German unification, it became a more normal big city in the world, and many, let's say, of the cool people left. So Karen and I met Karen there, of course, one of the other most important people. So after unification, Karen and I, with our 1-year-old son Carl, went to the UK after unification. Actually, we went to Wales in Swansea, where we didn't stay too long, just too much. Too much rain over there. So, but it was a nice place for us to migrate to. I also like to put this lecture a bit into context, because we all probably have, between her coughs, Theresa May was making it clear that she believes in the market economy and was strongly against setting up trade barriers. And I was wondering, let's really hope that history is not repeating itself, because when I heard her saying that between her coughing, I felt reminded to Walter Ulbricht, who in 61 said that nobody would have the intention to build a wall. And exactly that happened a year later. So I just hope May is not copying Ulbricht there, and I don't hope to see trade wars. Just to give you direction this lecture is going to take over the next half hour, 20 minutes or so. So I just hope it's not an Ulbricht succession in that respect. I wanted to show off a bit with technology. Let's see whether that works. Yeah, it does. Okay. So I thought to start this lecture in economics, I would want to point out that economics is a very old discipline, and we trace ourselves back to Aristotle and other ancient scholars. Greek scholars, but I thought to start with the economic effects of Brexit, it would be appropriate for me to refer to Karl Marx, actually, who was probably most studious disciple of Adam Smith, whose Wealth of Nations of 1776 is seen as the beginning of modern economics. So I'm not going back to Aristotle, so I just go back to liberal economics. I've picked Marx for various reasons. I think Das Kapital is the ever best-selling book in economics we have. And in various places, it's now celebrated for its 150 years anniversary. So I think that justifies to make the reference actually to Marx rather than to Smith. And of course, we all know that the implication of Das Kapital, namely that capitalism eventually might break down due to internal contradictions, didn't take place yet. maybe another 150 years or so. But there he got it somehow wrong. But who knows? The photos here show actually... Show actually a monument of Karl Marx in what was called Karl Marx Stadt, Karl Marx City, in East Germany, German Democratic Republic. It's at the center square. As you can imagine, against the background, it's big. It's a huge monument. And I happened actually to work in Chemnitz, as Richard got it right, for a year as a visiting professor, ironically sponsored by the Commerzbank in this Karl Marx town there. So this is one monument. The other one, of course, shows us shows us that Marx was another migrant from Germany. And this smaller monument is on Highgate Cemetery, where his remains lie, next to his wife Jenny, who was the Baroness of Westphalia. And if you want to go on a pilgrimage to Marx, it's probably nearer to go to Highgate, which is anyway a wonderful place to visit, even without looking at Marx's monument. But it's worth going there. And I did actually pick this quote here, which is actually coming from this Marx's... I didn't mention. The Saxons call this the so-called Nüschel. Nüschel is not in my West German vocabulary, but I looked it up. It means hat or skull or something. So this is just the skull in East Germany. So I think that's something we got to know. And I picked this quote here, namely that the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it, because I thought that's the very spirit of the Leave campaigners. They really wanted to change the world and still want to change it. And that was driving the motivation to really bring about change. Whereas the Remainers, the Remain campaigners, probably I belong to that camp a bit nearer are more like the philosophers, yeah, just to get on with things as they are, actually. So that's why I thought this quote by Marx is appropriate, because he was really driving action rather than taking a laissez-faire, laissez-passer point of view. That's why I thought it's appropriate. Those of you who understand German, there are at least two in the room. No, there are four in the room. Sorry. Probably do know or should know that the original of Marx would read, die Philosophen haben die Welt nur verschieden interpretiert. Es kommt, and the kommt is important, darauf an, sie zu verändern. And this Ö, like in my own name, Umlaut, gives us an idea of Marx's upbringing, actually, in Westphalia. But just to have this as an introduction, I can always recommend Highgate as a little tour, pilgrimage, if you would like. But it is a nice place to watch. So now let's start the lecture here. Where am I here? Okay, I would want to identify three background themes we have with Brexit, and that might be a bit provocative, but I look forward to the discussion afterwards. I think it's clearly anti-liberal, and I would say this is what Friedrich Hegel, who was Marx's teacher, conceptualized as Zeitgeist. The Zeitgeist is anti-liberal. We see this in Trump. I don't mention the tie again. America first, we have UKIP, we have the Alternative für Deutschland, we have Front National. Since Sunday, we have the Österreichische Volkspartei. All these ideas are anti-liberal in that they put the national priorities over international one. So this is a zeitgeist. We don't know how long the zeitgeist will last, but it is really contradicting economic ideas, because I think you can be offbeat as you like as an economist. You would probably share the idea that free trade is to the benefit of all participating parties, maybe not to the same extent. Yeah? Germany has been long time been accused for benefiting more from the export surpluses than other countries. Yeah, so not to the same extent. But free trade is good in terms of economics. Now we have to do Trumponomics, I suppose, because this has changed. So this is Zeitgeist, that's the time we are living in. And let's see how long it lasts. But it's a fact, I think. And I come to some reactions from the public a bit later. Also, secondly, I think we should note it's anti-social in the sense that we live, the zeitgeist again is such that the French president can openly disrespect the unemployed because he believes they are lazy. And also we have the highest level of inequality within and between countries in the world since we ever had, since we have written records. We don't know about the Roman Empire, so but this is the highest inequality we have. And again, it's zeitgeist because it's not really disputed, and the background is that if you have higher inequality, you set an incentive to work more and work harder. So it is to the benefit of society. So that's how I understand the zeitgeist. And again, I don't see this going to come to an end very soon. It's just there, and nobody stops the rising inequality. So that's the second theme, I would say. And then now, this is the most puzzling one. I think it's anti-business, the theme here, because Brexit really is not good for business management and the economy. And that's against the zeitgeist. And that's what I'm trying to understand. How can it happen? And this leads me back to what I said. Try to disentangle economics and politics. I don't understand why businesses are so late coming forward saying, well, this shouldn't have been done. So there wasn't an early resistance saying, well, this is utterly wrong and it will lead to negative economic consequences in all sorts of various things apart tourism, but it didn't happen, and that's what I find absolutely astonishing, in particular for the UK, because when this is a country Bonaparte referred to as a nation of shopkeepers, and how could they be anti-business? That is still puzzling me, raises my eyebrows, and I have some serious questions of why that has happened. And that's what I want to explore in a moment. Before I move on into the analysis, I want to make sure that I know where I am, yeah? I know where I am. I had two pieces in the Bournemouth Echo, and they will report on today's night as well. And one was actually expressing the concern I just issued, namely that this is against business interests. How could that be, actually? And also I did say there's a problem of possible losses of jobs. And the interesting part was the reactions I got. So on that one, I got 59 comments then. And this is setting the tone. I just didn't pick two examples which are out of order and out of line. The tone is those who can't make it in the real world teach. Yeah. And also it's time to ignore these self-proclaimed experts. I mean, I never self-proclaimed myself, but That was the reaction, and that actually makes me think that maybe there's a fourth theme, that the Brexit Leave campaigners are anti-education, really, if you come forward with that strong view. I know where the territory is here. We come to that in a moment, but there was a very strong reaction. And now let's have a little look at the facts for a change rather than the ideology behind it. The facts are relatively easy. This is the overall result in the UK. An average of 52 people wanted to leave, 48 wanted to remain. Dorset is very different. Here, about 62% of the voters wanted to leave, with Weymouth and Portsmouth having highest majorities of 22% and a 75% turnout. So we are really in the Leave campaign territory here, and that, of course, coincides with the reaction of the Bournemouth Echo there, if you're in that situation. And I think it's only West Dorset, which is an exception due to its liberal tradition there. Otherwise, we are in the Leave campaign territory with all these consequences. There are some reasons for that, and I come to that in a moment. So if we look at the facts, it's very clear it's the elderly. So those, including me, over 50 and even more so over 65, who voted for Leave. Whereas the overwhelming majority of the young people wanted to remain. So this is a clear picture of the population demographic background. There might be reason for that. I have been discussing this with, for example, Graham, because the elderly do remember the past. They might remember times before 72, and these might be good memories, actually. I recall I was a young man, I was a boy at the time. I don't recall any issues crossing the Denmark-German border for our summer holidays, where we often went. We just stopped by, and my dad would have the boot full of beer, as much was allowed, because alcohol was prohibitively expensive, as it still is in Denmark. But I don't recall this as a big problem, whereas the young generation doesn't know how it was, so they might believe this will be a different world or so. That might actually not be the case. I'm speculating here, yeah? But it's just possible that the memory is an issue here. So if I move forward a bit with the demographic, then we can clearly see that's not just the elderly, but also the less educated population. So those who are not graduates have as a best degree a GCSE, voted for leave, and the better educated one voted for remain. That sounds a bit critical, I know that. So it's the elderly and the not so well educated who was driving us into the leave campaign. But that's what we have here as a picture. I think the demographics also clearly show it's English. The Northern Irish, understandably, and also the Scots are Remainers. And that's, I think, an observation really important, in particular if we look into Dorset a little bit further. Education is here proxied by Sun readers and Guardian readers. Not sure whether that's good. You better stick to the hard facts, highest qualification, lower than GCSE or AB class as terms of education. So I think we have a clear picture here as to who voted like what. So after having looked at these pictures, I want to look at the process. The process is simple of Brexit, and I think we have just seen the conversations Mrs. May trying to convince Mrs. Merkel that we should go ahead with negotiation before settling the divorce bill. That's not going to happen. So the EU, led by Germany and France, very strongly made it clear that before this exit bill, we would probably better say, isn't settled, there won't be negotiations. And the bill would include some outstanding budget commitments, EU official pensions, which have to be paid from somewhere, some contingent liabilities, and other costs of these withdrawals. So we are talking here about sums between 25 billion and 100 billion. So we're not talking about peanuts here. And as long as that's not settled, the EU will not negotiate. And I think I'm under no illusion that Mrs. Merkel means what she says on this occasion. So it's not going to change. And we have to put up with that. And this leads me a bit back to businesses, because I couldn't help doing this now. Where is it? I thought it's a good illustration of Brexit is, of course, The Merchant of Venice. This would be the hard Brexit here, which is illustrated with a picture and quote from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice in 1600. So Monsieur Barnier could be seen in the role of Shylock, and of course Mr. Hammond could be Antonio. And I just tried to read the dials just as an exercise. Go with me to a notary, seal me there your single bond, and in a merry sport, if you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such sum or sums as are expressed in the condition, let the forfeit be nominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh, and to be cut off and taken in what part of your body pleases me. And I think that's a hard Brexit, and that's why business is fearful of that going to happen. Yeah, I don't think we will really be invaded or slaughtered here. And of course, the story of the merchant doesn't go like that in the end. But I think that's a fear, really, and that's the illustration. That's definitely what businesses don't want. So what do they want? They want transitional arrangements. That's what business want to see. And I would still, where is this here now, 10, 11, 12. I would say these transitional arrangements would cover migration, of course, of human capital, like myself. I come to that with a few figures later. Of course, this would be part of transitional arrangement. Let's say over 2 years. You can have it over 5 years, 2 years, but that's what businesses want. And then, of course, trade of commodities, but probably most important from the UK perspective, trade of financial services is part of the transitional arrangement. So what are we going to do over the next years? after the settlement of the divorce bill. Nothing is going to happen before that has been settled. Then we have the we have Shylock here. And of course, it also includes infrastructure. I come back to that in a moment. Nick Gregory is in the audience somewhere, and he knows a lot about the infrastructure, which is supported largely by the European Union. And I think a good example is the Irish border, where we say, where is this now? Well, I have to read this out from here, that Ireland's horse racing business relies on long-standing agreements that allow the tariff-free and unfettered movement of thousands of horses between the UK and Ireland. So this is just an example of a border which does exist in reality. Of course, you then... And nobody, so to my knowledge, puts into question the Good Friday Agreement. I haven't heard anybody saying that that needs to be cancelled. We have some Irish colleagues in the audience who can probably confirm that. So then, can the Irish-UK border be different from the French-UK border? that is something not so easy to imagine. And of course, the Dover-Calais passage is the obvious bottleneck here. And I'm quoting somebody from the UK Border Force, a Mr. Dixon, who has been living in Dover all his life. He says, from the 500 or so lorries going to non-EU countries that we process now, 500, we could suddenly be doing up to 10,000 a day. And just say, I don't know how we or Dover itself could cope with an increase of that scale, yes, from 500 to 10,000. Of course, the same applies across La Manche in Calais. Yes, so one has a practical issue here, how this will actually be done. And he can't imagine that. I can't either, but I thought it's good to have this here. Oh. Now my show-off doesn't work, that's not so. Okay. I need to move this manually. So what's the effect then, the economic effects of the Brexit in this respect on the EU before I come to Dorset? I mean, I've picked Frankfurt here as an example, and these are estimations. So we assume that over 4 years, 10,000 new jobs in banks are created. And a careful estimation is that indirectly, that type of 10,000 jobs in the financial sector would generate at least 21,000 other jobs indirectly, or even up to 34,000 in Frankfurt alone, just moving the bankers over there. And in the region of Rhine-Main, this would be between 36,000 or even almost 90,000 indirect jobs. So we have a huge Brexit effect, a positive one. And of course, uncertainty is key here, but for the EU, uncertainty is positive. It has a positive prefix, which is very different in Dorset, which I want to look at now. Ah, I've got back to my technology here, excellent. So if we now come to Dorset, Well, this is of course self evident, isn't it? Nick Gregory is sitting over there, is running the Dorset Growth Hub, which is a sort of agency supporting startups, and we have been working together on access to finance for small and medium-sized companies. And of course, as you see in the logo, this is widely supported by the European Union. That's probably not going to continue here. So I think we have a very clear indication of a negative economic impact on businesses in Dorset. I think all of us have read the statement of the chief CEO of JP Morgan, who said if we vote for leave, JP Morgan will probably lay off 4,000 people in the UK, yeah, not just in Dorset, but they are the biggest private employer we have in Dorset, where they employ 4,000 people. So some of these 4,000 will be those we have here. They are actually processing here, and I think this is something we need to be aware of. The exception is maybe tourism. I mean, tourism could be positive, and we don't have figures yet, but that's a very simple economics reason, because we could just assume that a place like Weymouth, where the councillor thinks the drop of the pound will improve tourism, is helping our economy for simple two reasons: that the cheap pound might attract EU citizens to come over here, spend their holidays here because it has just been cheaper, but also that we might stay here rather than going abroad, and that would be positive. So that can be, and I don't want to question this at all. I think this is a real possibility. I still struggle with my show off here. Otherwise, I would say we clearly can say that Dorset as a region, like other UK regions, will suffer from the exclusions of some certain EU agencies and also programs and maybe some markets as well that we don't know. And then we will have poorer access to intelligence and information simply because we are not sitting at the table. So people won't necessarily tell us what they are up to. So I think that's very clear. There will be an effect on direct investment, domestics and inwards. So we don't know whether foreign direct investment from the EU to Dorset is going to continue. Probably not. And also, there might be some domestic inward investment going down because we lost our export markets. That would be the simple rationale for that. Also, we might have less access to future skills and existing skills, which we can normally draw from the European Union. People like myself, yeah. so that could be the case. And we might experience a divergence of standards and regulations, as the Irish example with the horses shows. We have the same standards and regulations at the moment, making it very easy to sell Irish horses across the European Union. But that might change, actually, that the regulations will be different, and then we have a trade barrier, whether Mrs. May would admit that or not. And finally, we'll have an impact on trade competitiveness, and we mentioned the exchange rate, tourism. That could actually be positive. So could be. Okay, the main issue I wanted to look at is really the uncertainty we have as a consequence of Brexit. And this I would put into, put down as questions rather than anything else. So if you look at, we mentioned JP Morgan as the biggest employer, we mentioned the Dorset Hub, but what's Airbus going to do? Airbus, are they relocating to the EU? Are they staying in Dorset with their supply chain? Is Lush developing new continental facilities, or are they staying here with us? We don't know. What we do know, that last year Alphatronics in Poole shelved plans of building a new factory because of the uncertainty. They just didn't know whether this would be a wise decision to do at the time. So it's shelved. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but that's a clear uncertainty. And finally, this is latest news. The NHS is suffering from more nurses and doctors from the EU leaving their job in Dorset than ever before. Yes, they're just going. And of course, we don't have to be too pessimistic. There are some optimistic local companies who think they will actually fare well in Brexit, simply because they either trade just within the UK or with America or Northern America. I mean, there was this interesting idea that if we leave the customs union with the EU, we might join NAFTA, which I found quite amusing, actually. but of course, there are such companies who are not affected by Brexit. And And that's what I wanted to point out here. I wanted to show off, but then it doesn't work. So if you look at the sector I work in, the university sector, we can say that we have about 25,000 academics in the UK. And of course, well, this is not showing now. I can just point it out itself. It's 23%. So that's a huge proportion we are relying on. Also, we have to see that 1,400 of this EU staff left last year. That doesn't include me. I'm here to stay. Yeah, I promise. But it is quite a worrying picture. And if I look at the department, accounting, finance, and economics, which I try to manage, I think we do quite well. But we have 32% of members of staff from the European Union. Nobody has left yet, and as I said, I don't intend to. I'm here to stay. What we did last year, we offered two jobs, lecturing jobs, to German economists. Both declined because of Brexit, because they said, it's too uncertain, I'm not coming to the UK at the moment. They had a relative working in Germany, said, I'm not going to move. And as Phyllis will remember as well, as in recent vacancies we had advertised, we had no application, yeah, zero application from the European Union, which is very unusual actually. So we normally always have some good people who want to come to the UK academia for various reasons. Not anymore. And hearsay has it from German colleagues, that is the opposite. Yeah, that German colleagues are flooding German universities because they want to go back. Not me. Don't get me wrong. don't get rid of me very soon. So I think I will actually stay. But I think that's the situation we live in, and I find it precarious, really. I'm not sure how to deal with it. Well, as I said, this never works. If you want, I just sort of put on a good show, but but there are some attacks as well. So the Remainers are sort of attacked as being non-democratic, and I'm worried about that. And Remainers are identified as sitting in these institutions. These are seen as the representative Remain campaigners, which would be the BBC. Interestingly, the civil service of the UK is in favor of Remain rather than exiting, which puts us into this practical problem I indicated with the border agency, obviously. So that I think was an interesting finding. Also, the city obviously is a bit under attack of being anti-democratic, because most of those bankers don't want to go to Frankfurt or Luxembourg. They want to stay in London. Quite for understandable reasons. I mean, Frankfurt is a provincial town compared to London. So obviously, they want to remain. And there are some leading universities such as Cambridge. I would like to see us there as well. But I'm not speaking for the university. I'm speaking for myself. Yeah, so I'm not sure whether we have, as a Bournemouth University, an official viewpoint, which I would like to see, actually. There are some top lawyers, which I'm not so interested in. But then my favorite newspapers, publications, are seen as Remainers. And that's The Economist and The Financial Times. And the views expressed in these publications are fairly clear in favor of Remain rather than leaving. And this is actually influencing me. That's what I read on a daily basis. And I'm worried about these attacks, because they say it's anti-democratic, which I can buy into in a certain sense. Namely, asking for a second vote is, in my understanding, a bit like, well, how often do we need to vote until we have the result we want? So I can understand the rationale, yeah, but not many people ask for a second vote. I would be against it, actually, because we have to put up with what has been voted. We've got to accept that. And so that's why people say this is anti-democratic. And that is worrying me thoroughly. And that's why I conclude with another migrant here. Interesting again from Germany, namely Karl Popper, who in his famous work, The Open Society and Its Enemies, famously said, "We must plan for freedom and not only for security, if for no other reason than only freedom can make security more secure." And I hold this quote in very high respect, and I think it's important that we follow this sort of doctrine. As a footnote, I should say that Popper, interestingly, I started with Marx, saw Marx's ideas as the worst enemy of the open society. but I think these migrants are still with us. I think the message of this talk is absolutely clear, that Brexit is harmful for business and the economy. I try to separate the politics, which is different. Just to reiterate, Dorset is extreme Leave territory. And I didn't mention a footnote there, but before we open the discussion, I've shown you the reactions to my Bournemouth Echo article, and don't know how this discussion will go, but just to reiterate, I was once teaching in the former president's office in Almaty, the capital, former capital of Kazakhstan. And the president had a secret lift into the cellars where there were secret escape routes out of town. I don't think Barclays has this. But I have a driver sitting in the back, so I think you can switch on the car already and get me out. But with this final remark, with no humor, as I promised you, I want to open the discussion. Thank you very much.